history that's happening in our church, in our churches. Now we're going to go outside of our own congregations because this is an area we're not necessarily dealing with as much, but we deal with it as we relate to other people. And we've seen it coming in. So we're going to be looking at the issue of postmodernism. We'll put that in the context of the other movements we've seen in the fundamental movement, Orthodox movements, versus the new evangelical movements. And this is one that's taking root, and it's taking root in a segment of the new evangelical world, so much so that it's making national headlines in some areas, although we don't necessarily see it that way. Probably the dominant theme one might consider out of postmodernism would be the idea of there's the tolerance, truth is personal, it's spirituality's fine, but it's not authoritative. Those concepts are making their way into academic institutions that one might not expect. Fuller Seminary might not be a big surprise that it embraced it. Dallas Seminary is a big surprise that they have professors who embrace it. Biblical Theological Seminary, that was really once in our orb, but that's been many, many years, decades since they've moved away, has embraced this type of theology as well. And it's not just in the seminaries, we see it broadly in the evangelical churches, so that we get national headlines about evangelical pastors who say that they deny hell. And in some senses, you'll read these things and go, okay, so there's where modernism was. These are supposedly the evangelicals, new evangelicals, but they're now denying some of the same doctrines that were denied before. So these things become somewhat concerning, and they're the things that we're going to continue to take a look at. In fact, out in Ohio, one of the leading Baptist institutions in Ohio of higher education was making the front pages of the newspapers, and they tried to damp it down as a school, making front pages of the newspapers as some of their faculty were accusing others of their faculty of embracing postmodern theology in the school. And so if eventually supporters were receiving DVDs and CDs trying to say, well, no, it's not really the case. But there was a good paper trail to say that potentially these ideas were continually making their way in. And if they were stopped there, and I think they were, well, that's a good thing. But just because you're in a Bible-believing church, a Bible-believing community, we're not exempt to some of these ideas. I was at a meeting of supposedly all evangelicals from Western New York, and all of a sudden I noticed as they were dealing with the abortion and opposing abortion and the pro-life movement here, and it was a good idea, but you know, I'm listening to one of the speakers, and the language that he was using, whether he realized it or not, was all postmodern terminology. And so, again, it's just one of those things that we should understand, because it's finding its way, unfortunately, into areas where probably some of you are living and moving, and people you're speaking with, you get together in a homeschooling group, or you get together in a pro-life event, or you're getting together with others, and you might find these concepts that are already making their way in. And of course, they're the kinds of things that we see all around us in the media is taking place as well. So let's think about reaching this postmodern world, because this is in part the pattern of the people that we see. And I was find it somewhat interesting. It was sort of like the time I was debating with a complete liberal modernist from Union Theological Seminary, where Briggs was, and he was trotting out these ideas that hadn't been accepted by any respectable theologian or archaeologist for at least 50 years, but that's what he was still trotting out. And I just kind of, I laughed and said, you know, if you really want to deny the faith, you just have to be more up to date, because this stuff is just so old hat. And there isn't anybody that believes this anymore. It's all been disproven. And I can give you some examples if you'd like. And you know what? It's the same thing. If we want to be reaching the world, but we're still trying to address something from 40 years ago, then we might not be touching on the issues that where Christians or non-Christians today are actually thinking. So let's discuss this whole idea a little bit. Modernists tried to devise a brand of Christianity that would reach a modern world. And as we've already spent a lot of time looking at that, we know that by the end of the day, what they had done was essentially destroy the heart of Christianity in the process. So if you want to reach a world that doesn't want to accept anything that's supernatural, and so you want to deny the remarkably supernatural things that are inherent in the gospel, and you begin to deny that Christ was born of a virgin, that he did miracles, that he died to pay for people's sins, that the scriptures inspired. By the time you get done that, you might reach a world, but what you're reaching them for is not the gospel. It's not for Christ. And so that's the concern that we see along the way, that we saw with the modernists. Well, in the same way, we're looking at a worldview now, because that's really what postmodernism is. It's a way of looking at an overarching philosophy that claims they have none, but it's an overarching philosophy that looks at life, and it says, here's how we understand life. And the question becomes, is that particular model or outlook on life something that is compatible with Christianity? And is that really what we're looking at here when we look at postmodernism? Because after all, the whole idea of knowing Christ is not that that's just one little thing that we fit into our life on a Sunday. You know, for so many people who are religious, I got a kick out of it. Somebody told me they were going to church. They were a member of a church. We're just dealing with this actually at the banquet that we were at with New Yorkers. And one of the people was walking up going, oh, I go to such and such a church. Well, so I just have, because I happen to know the pastor well, being related to him, I asked him a question, if you knew so-and-so, and the answer was he had zero idea who it was, and he was trying to pretend he knew who it was, and then it was, and so finally they did a little more research, and later on we found out, well, the individual is actually, probably goes, his in-laws go there, and he might go there on Christmas and Easter, a couple things like that, but he grew up Catholic and probably still is, and it's like, what? That's church attendance in some worlds, isn't it? You know, I show up at a church twice a year, and I count, that's my church, I don't even know who's there. But that's my church. And we have to think about our faith, and our faith isn't that, is it? Our faith isn't just going someplace a couple times. Our faith isn't just coming to the place where we say, okay, I've got an hour on Sunday morning, I've done my duty, and now I'm on. Your relationship with Jesus Christ affects you all the time, doesn't it? It affects how you think. It affects where you go. It affects... We're just teasing Russ. And it affects a whole lot of things about the way we live our lives, doesn't it? And so having said that, the concern is the worldview here, whether a person goes to a church or not, is the worldview in that church, is the worldview of those people compatible? Because the goal of the faith, according to 2 Corinthians 10, 4-5, is that eventually the knowledge of God and relationship with Christ is going to bring every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. And so that's how we would live our life. And when the Apostle Paul talked about spiritual warfare, he was essentially talking about, yes, there are the forces that go on that are unseen between the kingdom of heaven and this world. But he's really talking about that being played out in an ideological battle, in the way people looked at life and the way they lived their life and the things that they were committed to. He wasn't talking about grabbing swords to go fight somebody. And he wasn't talking about having some sort of a verbal insult, walking around a hill seven times and then, you know, insulting the demons and expecting them to all go away. He was talking about a real warfare that described real ideas about real truth. And so, and if we had even more time, and as it is, this might take 2 or 3 weeks, but if we had even more time, we would talk about, when we think about this postmodernism and defining it in maybe more nuanced ways, because whenever you're talking to groups that are conversant in postmodernism, and that's their practice, the tendency is to want to nuance every single statement and sort of nuance it to death without actually making a positive statement. So, but nonetheless, let's think about some broad definitions for postmodernism. Broad definitions for postmodernism, I'm going to start off by saying that there's an absolute denial of absolute truth. That's actually one of the things that I kind of love. We're not going to have any overarching systems of philosophy. We don't have any absolutes that we're committed to, but we will absolutely deny that there's an absolute truth, and that's our overarching worldview. So, hence is the reason I say it that way. But in reality, that's not necessarily objective. So in their broad definitions, we might say this, it's hostile to objectivity and authority. Postmodernism as a philosophy is hostile to objectivity and to authority. And so, words we're probably familiar with, tolerance and diversity are primary virtues. Tolerance and diversity are primary virtues. It has been moving in this direction for a long time. Dr. Bloom, who was a keen observer of the direction of our nation as a sociologist in other areas, he wrote a book on the opening of the American mind, and in his introduction, one of the things that he said that I thought was so salient was, and I'm going to boil it down because it went on for a couple pages, but he basically said, look, I've taught all over. I teach people at all levels. And whether they're just coming out of high school, they're college students, or one of my graduate students or not, it doesn't matter whether they come from a politically conservative background or a liberal background. It doesn't matter what socioeconomic status they come from or not. The one virtue that Americans are universally taught to cherish over everything else is tolerance. And the chief sin is intolerance. And intolerance, in their mind, is as dangerous as Adolf Hitler or Stalin. It's that dangerous, and that's what it's likened to. And so tolerance and diversity become the chief virtues. Hence, even people who don't realize it get upset when they feel like, you know, the reason we have trouble with you Christians is why? Well, because you're people of a book. And when we have to deal with people of a book, radical Muslims, conservative Christians, you have this area like, we can't get you to negotiate. We can't get you to change because you have in front of you certain non-negotiables. That's intolerant. That puts you in the Adolf Hitler category, if the people today knew who he was. But that's another story. So, tolerance, diversity, primary virtues, and so is subjectivity. So is subjectivity. They prefer that. They prefer that there's not only one answer to things, that it's that this is, they think, most suitable for humankind, to prefer subjectivity over trying to figure out some objective answer. And they're hostile to a worldview, as I said before. They find a comprehensive philosophy of life. They find some perspective that answers all the main questions of living to be reprehensible and dangerous at best. So, let me just ask you a quick question. What does that do to truly biblical Christianity and evangelism? Just the idea that there is no, that anything that has answers, overarching answers for life, is a dangerous idea. Is that compatible with the Christian faith? So, when you're talking, you know, and you might want to prove that, you know, go out and try and prove that that God actually created the world in X amount of days, that doesn't really, that's not even the area they're thinking about. They're just thinking about the fact that an overarching philosophy in and of itself can be dangerous. So, no worldview, they say, provides universality and objective truth, a true perspective on life and reality. So if it works for you, it's okay. But if you want to impose that on anybody else, that's wrong. Absolutely wrong. Because it's absolute. That's just kind of how it works. So let's think about, continue on with some more here. Another aspect of this would be deconstruction. This is the hermeneutic of deconstruction. The hermeneutic of deconstruction, or the way to interpret things, deconstruction, would essentially go a little like this. What a document means to the reader is really more important to understanding it than what it meant to the author. Now, that plays out. I could just give a common example because we could talk about this, and I could talk to you about a Calvin scholar that I met, but let me just go something that's probably in the newspapers all the time. How does that play into picking a Supreme Court justice, for example? What's one of the common debates when we're looking for a justice of the Supreme Court? Help me out. What is it? Pardon? Abortion, that's one issue. Yes. How they interpret the Constitution, and what do we call those positions? And a living document. At least constructors, they think it's a living document. And so what it has come to mean to us is, and what the interpretation of anybody sitting on the court might be on that day is what it really means. We're not at all bound to take a document as it was written by its authors. But we can certainly bring questions to bear on what they meant, and we can then interpret it based on that. So when we're looking at the hermeneutic of deconstruction, it practices a systematic skepticism. So I remember sitting at a library. They had I had a day. I was in a meeting in California. I had a few hours, and I went up to Glendale, where they have a garden, which is nice, but what most people don't know is they have an extensive library. So they actually have one of the Wittenberg Bibles on display if you get in. If you're a scholar and you're registered to go there, you can go into a subterranean area where they're preserving manuscripts. And I was sitting down talking to a guy who was studying the works and life of John Calvin. But he, and at first I thought, well, maybe we have somebody, we have some sympathetic understandings and belief. Well, he, I think, at least believed that John Calvin was a human being who actually lived. I'm not sure beyond that than anything else that we had in common. So the practice of systematic skepticism, in one sense, is basically not constructive, but always looking to take something apart, always looking to question that how it could possibly mean what it seems to, on the surface, mean. It seeks to advance its own agenda. No, it doesn't. It doesn't do that. In fact, when I've been at debates where people who represent both schools, a hermeneutic of deconstruction, and others who represent a normal hermeneutic of interpretation get together, the nuancing gets kind of crazy. You know, you're invited to speak and to present a paper on what you believe, and you like to go second, and then you stand up and all you say is, well, you said this, we don't believe that. You said this, we don't believe that. You can go on for an hour, and you can have all kinds of questions from the floor asking, well, then what do you believe, and never once get an answer to that question. Except, well, we kind of believe some of these things, but it really requires a level of philosophical understanding most of you won't have, so I can't say that, but it doesn't mean what you said it means. That's the part of this deconstruction, this hermeneutic or approach to things that's discouraging, as well as this. The goal is to eliminate certainty, to question authority, to obliterate clarity, and to undermine objectivity. Because why? Well, because we don't think that if there's some universal that's trying to give an answer to everything, that's not helpful. What we really want to do is to get people to believe that there really aren't such definite, such concrete answers to things. We like to finish a discussion and a debate with, but it's all, you know, we're not sure, or there's a lot of questions, or we don't know the answers to. That's what we're finding when we look at postmodernism generally. And those are broad brush strokes, I understand, but I think they can be helpful as we go forward. And I also think it might be helpful for us to do a comparison to the two other worldviews that we have looked at so far and see how this has been progressing. So you've got a little chart like this, and let me start off with premodernism. Premodernism. Now, when I'm going to put a few rough dates on these things, and when I do, I am not trying to suggest that everybody who was born and lived in that time period thinks exactly the same way. I doubt that the early Greek philosophers and Solomon thought the same way. I doubt that Jesus and Caesar thought the same way. And I am fairly confident and pray that you don't think the way that most of the people who live out in this world around us think, so you'd be another good example. I'm also not going to say that these dates are like rough cutoffs. You know, it's sort of like you have to turn in a paper and pay your taxes, and if you miss the deadline and the extension, now there's a consequence. It doesn't matter what you do, there's that hard cutoff. It's not that. Instead, things tend to blend and bleed, and so there'll always be pre-modern thinking going on while there's going to be modern thinking. There'll always be modern thinking going on while there's post-modern thinking. And so studying all of these actually does have value, because many times we talk with people, and although they're living in an age that's become dominant by, say, post-modernism, they're very modernist in their approach to things. And because they're modernist in their approach to things, things that were very true in dealing with non-Christians in the early part of the last century are absolutely still true for many people today. Many people would be my age, because that's what they were being taught as they were going through school, and that's affected the way they look at things. So when we talk about pre-modernism, we're really talking about a time period probably from Thales to the French Revolution. For about 2,500 years in Western thought, this was the dominant thrust in Western thought. And when we consider that thought, we've discussed a little of this already. Some of this would sound very familiar to you. And by the way, this is not meant to be an insult, because I place myself in this category, but technically I would fall into somebody who's got a pre-modern worldview. Does that sound really bad, doesn't it? I didn't get to pick the title, sorry. So what's in the pre-modern worldview? Well, we believe there's such a thing as objective ultimate truth. Do you believe the Bible's true? Do you believe it's true for everybody? That's right. It's therefore objective truth. If you believe, and is it a matter of there? Here's a point that I believe is a fact, and I can debate it with 25 other facts, and maybe we'll come to something new. No, this is if you believe the Bible is absolutely the Word of God, it's truth, then you believe in ultimate objective truth. Furthermore, when it comes to reality, you don't believe that all of reality is comprised in this visible materialistic world. You believe that there are some things that are not seen, some things that we cannot measure, some things that are absolutely as real as the pew that I'm putting my hand on right now. Do you believe that? Do you believe God exists? Can you put him under a microscope? Can you tell me how much he weighs? Can we answer any of those? No, because we believe in the supernatural. And that is a part of reality. And then finally, authority. Where does ultimate authority come from? Ultimate authority comes from God. This is a basic characteristic that people understood. And even people who are pagans understood that ultimate authority came from something beyond them, unseen. And so they would worship various gods. But the understanding in a pre-modern world is that ultimate authority comes from God. If God can make you and God is going to judge you, then you better know what he thinks is right and true. Because that standard is not going to waver. I mean, you're not going to be able to walk there, up there on the day of judgment and go, well, but my pastor told me this. It's like, I'm sorry, then he was wrong. Because here's what God said. And here's what you need to know. And this is the standard to which you're accountable. The ultimate authority for what we know, what we do, what we think is going to be God. Well, if you don't, we might not like the title for it, but that's called the pre-modern approach to thinking. The modern approach is what we've seen already. And that's been in the modernist, which is why they were called that, the modernist or the liberal theologians. It's what's become part of the neo-evangelical theologians in many cases. So what's their view? Well, their view is also to recognize there is objective, ultimate truth. In other words, well, if we're going to have a discussion with somebody who is a modernist, we're not going to be saying it doesn't matter. We don't know. We're going to be saying, okay, you firmly hold this opinion, I firmly hold this opinion, only one of them can be right. They can't both be right. We have to find out what is ultimate objective truth. You might worship Allah, you might worship Jehovah, they aren't both God. Which one is God? You might think that God created the world in 6 days, I think it was a long evolutionary process over millions and millions of years, they aren't both right. We have to come to some objective answer. So when we're dealing with people like that, for example, a modernist who's been convinced that they're, and this will come into the next part, a modernist who's convinced that certain things happen in a certain way needs to understand that that's not the explanation for how they happen. And there, but modernists were also anti-supernatural. So here's the division in the road. The pre-modernists, like us, we make allowances and room for an eternal God who is the ultimate sovereign authority in life, and the modernist doesn't. That's what we're talking about. You know, and we've seen that show up right away. And, well, when you take a look at the Bible, what's the Bible? Is there a God who speaks authoritatively and tells us about these? No. Miracles couldn't happen. A flood couldn't happen. A creation couldn't happen. A man can't rise from the dead. All of those things cannot happen because you discount anything supernatural. And once you discount anything supernatural, it's going to affect your reasoning. And so that's what we see. The authority comes from science and not from human reason. Now, Bruce did a good job in giving some ideas about what's happening in the field of science today. We'll talk a little bit when we get done all this in a few weeks about where our culture team tends to be going. But this is the stepping stone that's really affected what we've done here in our land for about 30, 40 years. And this is my generation and a little after, and it still bleeds into this world. But now we're coming into postmodernism. And so when we looked at this modernism, that's pretty much from the French Revolution, up until the last 30 years, and then we've seen another major paradigm shift coming on. And in that paradigm shift, what we're seeing is now, once again, there is a return to this idea, and here's a key difference. Objective, ultimate truth if it exists, is unknowable. Objective, ultimate truth, if it exists, is unknowable. So if you think that you know objective, ultimate truth, if you think you have a book in your hand that presents it, that's a little arrogant, because objective, ultimate truth is unknowable. Now, people make compromises for that based on fields they work in, but this is generally how it's been. Now, I think this is changing again. It's mystical. And by mystical, what I mean is, you know, we used to have departments of pastoral care. I'll give you just like a down-to-earth example. Hospitals had departments of pastoral care, and they had chaplains in those departments. And now they have departments of spiritual care. And here's the difference. At first, one might have thought, well, they're just trying to make accommodation for Jews and Muslims and others who'd be uncomfortable with the title pastoral care. It's really been more than that. What we're really seeing is more of an emphasis on things that are mystical, but not necessarily Christian or of a particular religion of a book. Certainly there's room for ministers and priests and others to come in, but there's room for them in the medical industry today, I think, not as it was when I started. When I started, you know, we basically went to a Catholic hospital and the priest would give an orientation and they start to say something. It's like, going to quote something. I'm not going to try and quote scripture. You Protestants know a whole lot more of that than we do. But, you know, and then they talk about the value of pastoral care and why they want it. Now there's still value for it because there's this unknown spiritual sense of spiritual things can be good. Whatever a person believes, whatever that is probably good for them. And so you should encourage whatever it is that they might have some confidence in and trust in. We're really into mystical times now. We're into the spiritual now, and spiritual is quite broad, quite broad. Many people describe themselves as being spiritual. Don't say they're Christian, they're spiritual. There's an uptick in people who say that they believe that there is power in a spiritual world. But at the same time, there are fewer embracing Christianity. And they've stripped the supernatural of any authority. And so if you want to believe in the power of crystals, and he wants to believe in the power of Allah, and he wants to believe in whatever Rastafarians actually believe in, if anything, whatever those might be, you know, we're going to go like, okay, that's fine. You can believe those things, and that will probably help you. That's good. You know, you want to pray? Fine. You want to just think good thoughts? Fine. It's all spiritual, and spiritual can be good, but it's not authoritative. So, you know, don't tell me I need to pray to a God who happens to be revealing himself in the scripture through Christ. That's a little too direct. That's a little too narrow. It's a little too authoritative. So each individual determines what they want to believe in, and that ought to be fine because, after all, ultimate truth is unknowable. I could toss you out a trick question right now and say, who is Thomas More? Some of you immediately go, oh, I know who Thomas More is, you know, and I go back to the English history. It's like, no, not that one. There's a Thomas More today, and he's very involved in modern spirituality. And you'll read articles from him, and he'll be encouraging people and coaching them on how to create their own religion. And so he himself gives his own spiritual heritage, and I pick something from here and something from there and something from the next place and toss it all together. And that's a challenge. That's okay, supposedly. He wants you to develop your own kingdom, your own religion, your own philosophy that's going to help you with that. And so and when you're living with those ideas, then there is no ultimate authority. Now, that's not saying there isn't an ultimate political authority. There isn't an ultimate military. There aren't authorities on life in life. There isn't anything that says that, you know, you get to go over the head of the, you know, the local sheriff and do it with impunity. That's not the point. But the point is that theologically, philosophically, there's no ultimate authority that can any longer truly determine right, wrong, good, evil. And that's the world we've come to see and live in for these many years. Yes? Very different altogether. So in Eastern thought, for example, I'm not as conversant, but, you know, we do work in a Buddhist country, and even the people there don't know much about Buddhism. And what I will tell you is that generally when I'm in the East, that the one basic difference is that they would almost start out here because the belief is that there is this idea. In fact, I guess I've said it before. I still remember, it brings it clearly to my mind, I was landing in Bangkok reading a Thai paper, or Cambodia, reading a Thai paper that was in English. And on the front lower half was a whole discussion about Western Christianity and Western thought. And one of the things they said that was the most, to them, is the most ridiculous concept whatsoever is the idea of any kind of a personal deity. Because and they would just go on and go like, because everybody knows that there's a spirit that's at work and throughout that the world and in the elements and all these things, and it's not a personal deity. So, I mean, if you want to put it in colloquial terms, an underlying approach to spirituality in the East is Star Wars. You know, there is a power at work in the universe. There's a bright, a good side and a dark side. And so you'll see that showing up in the native Korean theology. You'll see that showing up, I think, in some of Japanese Buddhism as well. And then layered in with that all the time. So, I'm talking to people like in Myanmar, unless you're from a distinctly Christian clan, every boy and many girls spend time in a monastery twice. So they go there at the age 5, and they spend a year, and then they come out, and then they go back in their teenage years for another year. And so they spend their time, you know, you'll see them outside the door every morning. You know, the boys are in a lighter shade of sage, and the girls will be wearing pink shawls, holding a big begging bowl, because they go door to door, giving you an opportunity to do good for your soul by giving something to the monks. And so that's how they feed themselves. And so that's kind of what goes on. There's that attitude in those worlds, that it's a pretty general, there's a general spirit at work. Now, as I say, layering into that, there are local pagan religions. And so, Nats, as I think they're called. If you want to get a good picture of the belief structure in that part of Southeast Asia, what's fairly common and all understanding, if you come into the main entry coming back from Thailand into the airport, there is a statue that's almost the length of our sanctuary up in the middle. It's a display. And on there, I forget what creature, I think it might be a turtle or whatever's in the middle, and around it is this large serpent coiled. One end goes in one direction, the other end goes in another direction, and there's like sprites and gnats, and so there's like good and evil figures. And they're having a tug of war over the earth using the serpent, you know, as like a rope, playing tug of war. And that's truly the picture. If you really want to know, that's truly the picture of what probably most of the rural people believe, is that there are these spirits at work along the way. So it reflects many things that we see here. There's a reverence. When I was in Sri Lanka, one corner, I'll use pictures of these things because some of them are hard to explain. So I think it devolves in secular society, an increasingly secular society, to a commonality. So I came up to an intersection. It had three directions. It was a main intersection in Gali. And when we're there, there are three statues, one on each corner. One is a Hindu god. One is the Buddha. And the third is the Virgin Mary. And each one is encased in plexiglass with a slot in it, so that travelers, and they literally do, they just stop by, they put money through the slot in order to earn good, whatever, fill in the blank based on your religion. Good. So I give money, and that's how I earn any value before God. So it's in like this, in one sense, it's really not modernism, it's not postmodernism in one sense, but it's like that in that it's mystical. It's like that it's very mystical, and it's kind of gone from pre-modern to post-modern in some of the societies that they develop, because they really just marginalize the faith now just to be something that still gives an aura of honor. And so, you know, in Thailand, it's interesting. I've seen people get arrested, actually. They think they're doing something really cool, and they'll come in, they'll have, like, one guy had a tattoo of the Buddha on his calf, the back of his leg, and he never made it through customs. They arrested him because that's dishonorable to the Buddha. And they're a little more intolerant on blasphemy in Thailand than we are here. And you'll still want all the Buddhists to be around to give a sense of respectability and authority to the military in Burma or the new leadership. So they make places for it, but it's pretty much marginalized. So we're coming back into Western thought, and let me just end with this for time's sake. We're looking to try and proclaim Christ to a postmodern generation as well, and to do, as David said, proclaim the Lord in our own generation. I mean, many people here have studied the Puritans, and you probably know the Puritan debates really well, but quite honestly, there aren't too many people who are debating those issues anymore, because that's no longer the generation we live in. Or you might look at something from some other time period. I don't know how many courses I've had in modern religious problems, so I can probably teach what I've been teaching that first couple of weeks back on this in my sleep. I'll ask Sharon if I actually have. But, that's something that was ingrained. But I'm not necessarily dealing with that as much anymore. And so if we want to be faithful to the Lord like David did, we want to serve God in our own generation. And so part of what that means is, as we're proclaiming Christ here, part of what that means as well is that we may be in a period where evangelism's got to take a look in a different way, and post-evangelicalism may become part of where we're living. To some extent, the large, big-box entertainment style places where they're trying to reach people are not prospering well. And we think of a couple of the leaders, people who want to say we need to change what we do too much to reach this generation, not address the ideas, but just change sometimes the gospel even. You know, we've had guys like out in California who basically do a survey of their neighborhood, find out what people who are not Christians don't like about churches, and guess what the number one answer was? Sin. They want to hear about sin. Well, let's style our evangelism so we won't talk about sin at all. We won't talk about this. Or you go over to Willow Creek in Chicago and look at basically something that is turned into an entertainment setting. I'm not trying to pick on how the music is or et cetera. I mean, literally, it looks like you're attending a show. And when Christians attend there and they're a little surprised and they say, well, what about, like some preaching? They say, oh, we don't do that on Sunday morning here. You know, if you want to get some Bible study and serious Bible study, you have to come to a group on Thursday night or whatever night it is. But we don't do that on a Sunday morning. In fact, I had students in my class from just across the river in Fort Erie. They told me that they were having some challenges at their church. I had asked them to bring back something from their sermon on Sunday, and they couldn't. Why not? Well, we're not having preaching. And I said, well, why not? And they said, well, we're going to go rake leaves. I said, well, what about the next week? Well, we're going to like a coffee house. They're like, help me out with this. And they said, well, our pastor doesn't like to preach. Thinking about a whole lot of stuff that I said, at that time might have been a little more direct, but there's a basic problem with that, isn't there? If you're a solo pastor and you're with a congregation and you don't want to preach, we've got a little problem along the way. So we need to take a look at some of the things that are happening in our age. We need to be able to address and respond to the philosophy and the worldview that's here, without trying to accommodate it in our lifestyle and our thinking to the point that we endanger the very gospel itself. And with that, I think we're done time for this morning, unless I didn't set my watch back, but I think I did. So we're done time for this morning, so let's close in a word of prayer. Father, we thank you for the faithfulness of your Son and the trustworthiness of your Word. We're thankful for the plan that you have begun before the foundations of the world that you are continuing. We're thankful for the confidence that you give us in eternity. Because you are an unchanging God who speaks truth and has accomplished the miraculous. And so, Father, we thank you that you have given us eyes to see these things and to understand them, not because of who we are, but because of the grace of your Son. And we ask, Lord, that you would make us faithful witnesses and good testimonies to these things as we go day by day throughout our lives. Work in the lives of our friends and our family and those that we meet, that they might know and embrace Jesus Christ, whom to know is indeed life eternal. These things we ask in Jesus' name. Amen.